American dream. He's just a common man, working hard with his hands. He's just a common man, working hard for the man. Hey, he's a American dream.
Welcome everybody to the Unscripted Wrestling Podcast, the hottest wrestling podcast in the world. I'm your host, Dan, and I'm here with the cast of Too Cool. We got Grandmaster Sexy and Scotty Too Hottie, Clinith and Eric. How we doing?
Good. How about yourself?
Pretty good. And I'm doing really well. And we have Rikishi here.
Wait, my ass is the biggest out of all of ours.
No, it's probably mine, but I'm the host. So.
How was your guys' week?
It was good. It was a good week. We're excited to be here to bring the people more wrestling. And the second half of our 1997 moments and matches list, the top 10 list. We did 11 through 5 last time. We're going to do 4 through 1 today. And Eric took a lot of time curating this list. He did a very good job.
No, we didn't. We're doing 5 through 1.
5 through 1?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Yeah, because we did 10 through 6 last week.
Okay.
I think.
No, we talked about number 5 already.
We did?
Yeah, that was Luger.
Yeah, it was Luger and Luger and Hogan from Monday Night Nitro.
Yeah.
All right, never mind. I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about.
So good. So, yeah, we're going to be here to
all
bring
good.
Part 2. 97 was an interesting year, hot year for WCW. A very good transitioning period for WWE, and they started to become a big game in town again.
And even to ECW, like, you got to put them in the conversation because they started, I mean, they not necessarily hot, but...
They did, but I don't think they're on the second half of the list.
Yeah. No, what I'm just saying is that, like, you know, 97 was a good year
Because wrestling was starting to get hot again. Yeah, there was multiple things doing it. Kind of like, I mean, I guess you can say that now because there's a lot of towns in game now again.
Yeah.
I still don't.
Which I lost.
Yeah, and that's great. I still don't think, I mean, like, ratings are very low and, like, it's not as hot as it was here, obviously. But that's also television and so many other factors.
Yeah, but you still have, like, so many places, so many things that are on TV or that, like, you're able to watch. Like, yes, not a lot of people watch MLW or Impact or Ring of Honor. But, you know, they still have television deals. You could still catch them on a TV basis.
Yeah.
WWE.
But you can also watch highlights and clips on YouTube, you know. I see WWE's YouTube channel get millions and millions of views off of clips.
Well, yeah, because not everybody has the attention span
to
watch a 2 to 3 hour show.
Yeah, especially a casual person. Not even a casual fan, but just a person that's like, oh, what's interesting tonight, you know?
Yeah, because, you know, with the right...
Nobody has time to watch 20 hours of wrestling each week.
Right.
Yes.
Like, with the writer's strike and all that, like, you might get more casual fans now.
Yeah, maybe. Who knows? Because none of WWE's writers are on strike, are they?
No. Which they should be because they all suck.
They strike against themselves. Well, and WWE's not a studio, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm sure they pay them. But, yeah, it's interesting, man. This was a crazy year. It'll be fun to talk about. And it's cool because we got 4 picks to go through here. And we got 2 WCW and 2 WWF. I think that's a good highlight of the year because both of them were doing very good. WWE started doing good business towards the end, but both of them had very good content at the time.
Right.
And WWE, because this is like the dawn of the Attitude Era. You can, if you want to make an argument for late 96, I guess you could try, but 97 is where it really started coming together.
Well, and you also got to look, you know, we talk about TV, right? WWE had Raw, and they had Shaq on Saturday night. They had superstars at the beginning of the year, but then they turned superstars into a highlight show because they realized they could not film so much content. Like, it was either film Shotgun Saturday Night or film Superstars, and they went with Shotgun Saturday Night instead. But then you had, like, all your, like, highlight shows, like Live Wire, Superstars. They had another highlight show at, like, 10 o'clock in the morning or something like that. I forgot what it was called, but it was another, you know, package show where they talk about, you know, mostly Raw and then, like, Shotgun or whatever. WCW, you had Nitro, you had Saturday Night, you had Worldwide, you had Pro, you had Main Event. So right there, that's a shit ton of content in just between the two companies.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing you got now. You have Raw, SmackDown, NXT. You have Main Event, which can be seen on Peacock or whatever. You have NXT Level Up, which can also be seen on Peacock.
Yes.
AEW's got Dynamite, Rampage, Collision.
A lot of
content.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, you know, when people say, oh, less is more, yes and no, but, like, when you have a lot of people on the roster, which both companies, like, now and even back then did.
Well, yeah.
You have to find a way. Instead of having somebody work three shows,
yeah,
you have, okay, so back in 97, let's say Luger and Flair, just as an example, are main eventing Nitro.
Mm-hmm.
Saturday night, you're going to get the Steiner Brothers Harlem Heat main event in that. On Pro, you're going to get a main event of Ming versus Hacksaw Jim Duggan. On Worldwide, you're going to get the main event, Dean Malenko, Chris Jericho.
Yeah.
All right. That's how you're different.
Yeah.
So, like, the same person is not going to main event every show. You have a different set of people almost that work like the different set of shows.
And I agree with that practice for the most part, because I think if you're going to do it, that's the way to do it. But my only issue with it is that it never works. Any of that. Like, the three-show format never works. The having multiple, I think less is better. I think there should be multiple shows in town. I think an AEW needs to exist. TNA needs to exist. MLW
right.
needs to, but, like, I think if they all did one show, and I get WWE at fucking 1,000 people or whatever, but having the different brands and shit for one company has always hurt them. It's never done good business, and it never will, because people want to see. Not everyone wants to see fucking, you know, Yoshitatsu or fucking, and he hasn't been there for a long time, but not a lot of people, not everybody wants to see fucking, like, everybody, you know?
Yeah.
It's great to have a lot of people on the rosters and shit, but some people just want to see Roman Reigns and wants to see him once a week. So let's fucking just do one show a week and do him and do to the top guy.
And I think Impact and MLW, because they follow that format, they have their weekly show.
Yeah.
And then that.
I've always thought that's the way to do wrestling, because especially when you're doing pay-per-views every month, you're already stretching yourself thin. So having different shows and trying to make all these other guys special is very hard. And those shows never do as well as the main show.
Yeah.
Thunder never did Nitro.
I think, though, like, if they did kind of like a format, like if they did like an hour show and it was squash matches and then maybe one main event.
It's good for the hardcore guys, regardless,
yeah.
because you're always going to want to see, oh, like, what is Johnny Gargano up to? What is this guy doing? Like, you want to see everybody work. A lot of hardcore fans want to see everybody. So it works for that to have, like, a WCW Pro or a or anything like that. But
if there's a story, yes.
But
if there's not a story, then.
But if you're just trying to make three different shows and trying to make a star for each show and every, and, like, that's very hard to do, man.
Well, and I'll give you...
Making one guy special is hard enough.
I'll give you one pure example of, like, a story, and then we can get to the list.
Okay.
Back, I think it was, like, May of 97. I saw it because there's, like, a compilation thing on YouTube from May of 97. It was all the Worldwide shows.
Yes.
And the main event of the Worldwide show was High Voltage versus Public Enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they kind of had a feud, which we actually covered the blow-off. On our think, actually our first edition of War Drums when they had the Philly Street Fight.
Right.
So Tony Schiavone billed it on Worldwide, the big return match, High Voltage versus Public Enemy. This was on a Worldwide in May.
Yeah.
Which they taped back in February. The Philadelphia Street Fight was on April 14th. So they billed it. They tried to tell a story about it, but...
They fucked it up.
Not necessarily fucked it up, but it's like...
They told it out of order.
Yeah, they told it out of order because the blow-off had already happened.
Yeah, so what are you building to?
Yeah,
you're building to something that already happened. Stupid.
Yeah.
It's like putting out a TV show with the episodes out of order.
Right, exactly, which actually has happened before.
Yeah, like it happened to Firefly, which is a critically acclaimed show, but like the way the episodes came out, people are like, this doesn't make any fucking sense.
Yeah, and another show that is actually very, very synonymous with their episodes being out of order is a show called California Dreams, which is technically a ripoff of Saved by the Bell.
Okay.
And they're like season five.
Yeah.
The one guy on there, Jake Summers, you know, biker, leather jacket and all that. His girlfriend at the beginning of the season was this girl named Lorena. They broke up like a few episodes into the fifth season. A couple episodes go by, he's with the other girl that he's with.
Yeah.
But then in like episode like 12 or 13, he's back with Lorena. So like
stupid.
It was taped earlier in the season, but they aired it out of order because they're dipshits.
Yeah, who talks about California Dreams, you know?
Yeah.
That shows you how well that method works. It doesn't.
Right. You know, well, yeah, because like
stories
I said...
Stories are meant to be told in order.
Yeah. Like I said, like it was a ripoff kind of Saved by the Bell.
Yeah. And who knows if the episodes in order would have made it an iconic show. Who knows? But it didn't help not being that way. And it's the same thing for wrestling or anything. When you're telling a story, you want everyone to know what's going on throughout the whole story.
Yeah, pretty much.
Flashbacks and shit are fine, but, you know. All right, let's get into the list. 10 through 6, we did or 10 through 5, we did last week. Number 10 was ECW's first pay-per-view, Barely Legal. Number 9 was Kurt Hennig turning on the Four Horsemen at War Games.
It still pisses me off.
Number 8 was Bret Hart and Undertaker at SummerSlam for the title.
Very underrated match, by the way.
No, and number 6 was Austin winning the Royal Rumble.
What was number 7?
Bret Hart, WCW debut.
Okay.
And number 5 was Luger and Hogan for the WCW Championship, August 4th, 97.
Which we have talked about a total of like 7 times on this show because that's how we've covered it.
But
like,
we like it.
Well, because like, or not 7 times, I'm kind of over-exaggerating, but like we covered it when we did Luger's top 10 moments and matches.
I think that
then we watched the show.
I think that's right up there with Shawn Michaels and Triple H fucking as our most revisited topics.
It's got to be.
All right, let's go to number 4. Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio Jr. for the what's up? For the
oh no, go ahead.
Okay, my bad.
For
the Cruiserweight title at Halloween Havoc, Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio. This is a match, mask versus belt match.
Right. Which, by the way, Rey was supposed to lose. Bischoff wanted him to take the mask off, but Rey actually threatened to no-show.
Good. Because
he did not want to lose the mask.
Good. Know your worth.
And Eric's just like, he's like, Rey, you're actually a good-looking guy without the mask on. We need to show that, like, you're attractive and all that. And he's only like 22 at the time. And Bischoff's just like, and Eddie's too hot. We can't take the belt off him.
Well, and like, let's be honest, Rey was right in the whole scenario.
Yeah.
Because what is one thing that's synonymous with that man? Not even just Lucha Libre as the mask. What do kids wear to the shows? The mask. What has never worked as an angle trying to take it off him? The mask.
Yeah.
And they've done it in extraordinary ways with talents like fucking Jericho and CM Punk, and it never works, and it always comes across as kind of cringy because you need him in the mask.
Right. Like, he does not – I don't think he's made an appearance with the mask off since 2001.
Besides them taking him off him, because, like, Jericho successfully did it.
Yeah, well, what I mean, and but they won't show his face.
Yeah.
Like, he'll cover his face.
Yeah. But, like, the mask is, and it always, it's just synonymous with him. He is the mask almost. Like,
yeah.
He fucking, people love that shit, especially kids. They love the, because it feels like a superhero. Any more, and Lucha Libre as a whole, and it is a good, the mask versus match runs deep. The mask versus mask match in Lucha Libre culture.
Right.
That's way before WCW. So you can't be like Bischoff is trying to ruin heritage, because he's not. It's a main. It's a thing.
Right.
Guerrero's been in one before and lost. They do the hair versus mask things all the time over there.
Right. And the thing about this was, you know, when Ray said, "Look, I don't want to do," it, and Bischoff caved in. I think Conan had a lot to do with that too, because Conan was kind of that bridge between Bischoff and the luchadors.
Yeah.
So Bischoff's just like,
he was their voice.
What?
He was the voice.
Yeah.
He was their voice. He was their postman.
Right. So Bischoff's just like, all right, fine. We'll put the title on you, but it's only going to last a couple of weeks because I got to get the belt back on Eddie because Eddie's too hot. And Ray's just like, fine, just don't make me lose the match. And so it was kind of like one of those things.
It works, though. The thing is like, even that backstage drama, I don't mind it because that made it what it was. Because that match isn't as good if he loses and gets the mask stripped. So I'm glad he was a little bit of a diva. And him dropping the belt to Eddie or whoever afterwards was fine. He didn't need to hold the belt for a long time. But he got his moment. This match is fucking iconic. People still talk about it.
Yeah, because this was... Basically, when you have a main event of Hogan and Piper in a cage, and you have the trilogy matchup between Diamond Dallas Page and Macho Man, you have Flair and Henning, it's like, are people really going to talk about Rey Mysterio and Eddie Guerrero? By the way, the answer is yes.
Yeah, I mean, if you bring up this show...
Yeah.
Anybody's going to tell you what the match of the show was.
Right.
They're not going to talk about Piper and Hogan in the cage, that's for damn sure.
No, not at all.
No.
This made the card, and it was a good story, it was great wrestling, it was a perfect interpretation of, like, what those two guys could do, and that they could do it at a high level, and they could easily do it in the main event. Nobody saw yet, no one wanted to see, and that's fine. They both would go on to have their moments. But they showed that, like, we can put on a good story and also put on a really great fucking wrestling match, all wrapped into one. All
exactly.
Just in psychology. We don't even have to talk that much. Just let the psychology of the match tell the story.
Right.
And that's what made it, like, that's what makes this. And Ray getting his big moment at the end. Like, first of all the flip, and people might, like, if you're a fucking big Young Bucks guy or something, and you're a big AEW fan, and you see these motherfuckers slipping and flopping every fucking couple days, then you might go back to this match and be like, so what?
Yeah.
But for what this did for wrestling and, like, the style, and they didn't make up this style. I'm not saying that. But pushing it to the forefront and making people go, oh, this shit's fucking cool. This match helped a lot with that.
Right. Well, because you also have, at this time, there were, like, the luchadors were kind of fun to watch, but they also weren't polished.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you had guys like Juventud Guerrero, and I love Juventud, but he was very botchy. Okay, for a while.
Yeah.
The only person that can technically come close, well, there's two guys, actually, that could come close to how good, you know, Eddie and Ray could kind of fly around without botching every other move.
Steve Malenko and who?
Well, no, Malenko wasn't a flipper.
No.
Psychosis and Ultimo Dragon.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Like, right now, like, those four luchadors, and then you could probably put Hoovy in the top five because Hoovy is after them, but those are the top five luchadors, like, in my opinion.
Oh.
Okay?
Absolutely. I mean... Yeah, Ultimo. I guess Ultimo has to. He's Japanese, but I guess you got to throw him in there, right?
Yeah, because he trained also in Mexico.
Yeah, and he's very lucha. What happened to Shima at AEW? I fucking liked him at Double or Nothing. What happened?
I don't know, but like, so like if you take Dragon out because he's more of a Japanese wrestler, then it would go Eddie Ray Psychosis.
And then La Parca.
Well, but La Parca was different because La Parca was, you know, had the gimmick with the chair and all that.
And it was huge.
And was huge. But La Parca set himself apart from the other luchador. I mean, and they all kind of tried, like Ray set himself head above shoulders above the rest, as did Eddie. And Psychosis was right there. Like, Psychosis really was kind of like the leader of the rest of them.
Yeah.
Because he was the best. I think he was the best worker, you know, that wasn't Eddie or Ray. But La Parca set himself aside because La Parca had a different character, had a different approach.
Yes.
Like, La Parca could work with the bigger, like, middleweights or heavyweights.
Because he was a middleweight. He was big.
Yeah.
But this match, Clint, let's talk about this match a little bit, Ray and Eddie.
Clint?
Yes? Yeah. Oh.
Well, I was trying to get your opinion on Eddie and Ray.
I got supposed to wrapped up and like, hey, what you guys thought about? I was like, yeah. But anyway, with that match, I think Ray and Eddie, I think going to Halloween High had to be like one of the first Cruiserweights matches I watched and actually really, really enjoyed from start to finish. I mean, it was vicious, and I think it was on par one of the best matches Cruiserweights I've ever seen. My first Cruiserweight match, and I was like, wow, I didn't really, really think about it. I thought the light heavyweights at the time was all right back in the U.S., but when I witnessed Ray and Eddie, I said, these guys can prove that they can do anything just as good, even better than what the big guys do in basic wrestling. And it really got me into, like, the high flyings and the different style of wrestling, which they interpreted in that match.
Right. And that's the funny thing, too, like, with this match, you know, this was like one of the time, because Malenko was usually the one that could really put the Cruiserweights in like that prime spot or whatever, right?
Yeah, but like you said earlier, he wasn't a flipper.
Yeah.
You had two guys flying around, dude. And he's usually like the guy grounding the match, right?
Right.
This was so cutting edge for what it was. And like Clint said, it's one of the best Cruiserweight matches to this day.
Yeah.
And these two just, they put on something that it's like, you can tell they really wanted it.
I think, like, because a lot of people always hold in high regard Ray's match at Bash at the Beach 96 with Psychosis. Because that was, like, one of the hottest openers the company had ever had. And yes. But then, like, so that was, like, always how they set the bar. And then, like, you know, Ray's matches with Dean or whatever. But Ray and Psychosis had kind of that flippy deal. This one, Ray and Eddie surpassed that because obviously Eddie's a, you know, head above shoulders better worker than Psychosis, even though Psychosis is pretty good himself.
Yeah. It would be close to a five-star match.
Yeah.
And these guys, like, love each other and the chemistry's just there.
Right.
Like, we talk about when you love the guy you're working with, and we usually use that as a drag on Hunter, but, like, in any fucking business or whatever, unless it gets distracting, obviously, when you're working with somebody that you're really fond of, usually magic can happen.
Right.
Sometimes it can't, but, like with Edge and Christian, maybe. But with these two, it's like they were going to put on the best match of the show. And whenever they go out there, that's their mindset. And I've never seen a bad match between the two.
I don't think there ever has been a bad match between the two.
I love their whole rivalry. I even love the fucking cringy poppy shit. I love all of it. So, and this was the first one? Or no?
This was their first one they did on pay-per-view. They had a couple of Nitro matches.
Okay. All right.
But this was probably their best match.
I would agree with you, Eric. All right. Number three, we have the rivalry that took over 1997, which is Sting and Hogan in the NWO, but basically the whole storyline. And Eric, this is a big one that you put on the list, and I agree with you, but why don't you tell the good people why you think this deserves to be here?
But because mostly every week, this story was surrounded with Hogan and Sting. When is Sting going to come back? Maybe not beginning of the year, if I remember correctly, but at least towards like this, in the summer, it was like every week, when is Sting going to come back? Even in August, they tried to get him a contract and give him a match against Mr. Perfect, and he turned it down. And he wouldn't speak to management or anybody for a week, for almost a year, storyline-wise. And then finally, the match happened, and finally he agreed Hogan versus Sting would happen at Starrcade. It was a slow build to Starrcade, and it wasn't a perfect storyline, but it told what was the two biggest stars in WWE at the time.
So,
right. So my question is this. Is this like when Sting went from like the, I guess the American Sting or what do you call it, Surfer Sting, to the black and white Vigilante Sting? Is this what we're talking about?
Yeah.
Or just after that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all a part of it.
So, like, here's my thing. I think some parts of the buildup were better than others. Like, you know, and I've talked about, like, when Sting firmly said that he was part of when he jumped the NWO at Uncensored 97 and let everybody know that, hey, I'm back with WCW, that was a big moment. When he dropped Bischoff for the first of, like, four or five times, that was a big moment because that was a key part of the story. When he... when he put the crow down in the middle of the ring while they were celebrating the NWO's birthday or whatever.
Yeah.
To basically, nobody thought that he was, even though like for weeks, like everybody knew that he wanted Hogan, but J.J. Dillon wanted him to talk. And J.J. Dillon and Gene Okerlund, because Gene Okerlund had to play stupid. Mm-hmm. They're like, Sting, you need to talk. We don't know what you need. And you have Mike Tenay, Bobby Heenan, and Tony Schiavone in the background saying, he wants Hogan.
Yeah.
You fucking moron.
Yeah.
That's why, like, if we ever see J.J. Dillon at a convention, you need to slap the shit out of him and tell him that he was a fucking moron in 97. But, like that stuff was kind of dumb. But it's just like, you know, when they finally put the crow, he flew the crow down to the ring and the crow almost actually took Bischoff's finger off.
Yeah. All the extra shit was stupid in ways. A lot of the J.J. Bischoff stuff.
Yeah.
A lot. And some weeks felt very filler. Like when it's like when they attack Sting or Sting attacks WCW guys, the fake Sting. And like when we watched that episode, I was like, this is filler NWO bullshit.
Yeah.
And it's Ric Flair trying to fucking, and Bischoff arguing who gets to like close out the show by talking.
Yeah.
And Flair's like, yeah, let me talk. And he's like, yeah. Like, it's like, this is fucking stupid. But then there's like things we've watched where like Hogan and Bischoff are in the ring demanding, we want Sting or whatever. And then he comes down like from the rafters and Heenan's like, you got him. And it's like, those are huge moments.
Yeah.
So this build, it is one of the best long-term storytelling year builds of all time. It beats Cena Rock. It beats it over the fucking head.
Yes.
Right.
It beats a lot of those, like when they've tried it, and WWE has tried it a lot lately. That's why Roman Reigns has been champion since I was born in 1997. Joking, obviously.
Yeah.
But
it feels like it.
Long-term storytelling is kind of something they've kind of tried to go back to. This is one of the best depictions of it because you had a character who was the face of what this brand used to be, and it wasn't working, So now you have this new thing that's making it cool again, but is aggressively anti what he was. So he changes his image and becomes this dark thing, and it's supposed to represent the sadness and mourning for WCW. And he rallies up and becomes the company guy they need and wins in the end. Me even just saying that is a story. That is a well-told, thought-out story.
Yeah.
For WCW, which is a company known for, like, last minute, like, oh, shit, have this guy run in. Like, oh, it doesn't need to make fucking sense. That is a story that makes sense all the way to the end. And I know what happened at Starrcade, and we've talked about it enough. But fucking even that and him getting his moment, like, if you take out the count shit, like, that is a perfectly well-told story throughout that year.
Well, the funny thing about that, too, is, like, you know, you even talk about, you know, how, like, you know, the last minute shit. When you have, like, a company that's on a basis that, like, they have a match written down, they're like, all right, we need to send fucking Macho Man out there.
Mm-hmm.
All right, who the fuck do we send him out against? And then you see Booker T walking down a hallway, and then you're like, fuck, go out and wrestle Randy Savage. And shit like that. Like, you know how, and they used to do that to Sting a lot, too. Like, Sting would be going out and wrestling, you know, fucking Kurosawa or fucking Pitbull Pittman or whatever the fuck. Like, again, like, and it didn't have to make sense. It was just, we got 10 minutes to fill, go fill it.
Yeah.
This is one of those times, though, where it's just like, okay, we're telling a story here that's making sense. So we don't even know if we're doing it right, because we have never made sense.
Yes.
We've barely made dollars. So, like, but they told it very well. And the thing is that, like, when they would take, like, breaks in between, which, if you tell a story for 52 straight weeks, it's going to get boring after, like, week 20.
And the fact that they kept this fresh for so long is very impressive.
Yeah. It means that they actually kind of knew what the hell they were doing.
Yes.
Yes. It's probably one of the best storylines in WWE.
Yeah.
Maybe of all time, like in both companies. I think it should at least be in a top 10 somewhere. Because it's fucking...
Yes.
It transcended. It was all the business was. For like, because this WCW is number one this year.
Yeah.
The WWE is doing fundamental things, but this is part of the 83 weeks where they're beating the shit out of them. So all kids are going to school and talking about and shit, and all people know about right now is fucking Hogan and Sting. They don't even give it, I mean, and the Cruiserweights and shit's cool to watch, but, like, it's Hogan and Sting. So, yeah.
What did Sting and Hogan do this week?
Yeah, exactly. That's the conversation at the water cooler. So definitely deserves to be here. All right, let's go to WWE for number two. We're racing along through here. We have one of the biggest, most talked about things ever. And this is something that people were definitely talking about. The Montreal Screwjob at Survivor Series with HBK and Bret Hart.
All right. And, you know, we've covered it multiple times. I mean, well, and everybody's covered it multiple times.
Yes.
To where it's just like, I think everybody gets tired of talking about it.
Yeah.
Basically, it was one of the biggest moments of the year, because it's just like, now wrestling is real.
Yeah. It's one of the biggest moments of all time.
Yeah. Because shit got real. And everybody can point the blame at whoever they want. I mean, I personally think, like, Bret Hart was pretty much, he didn't want to drop the belt to Shawn Michaels because Shawn Michaels said he would never put Bret Hart over.
Mm-hmm.
The easiest answer to that is, okay, he doesn't have to put Bret over in a title match, but you have a group called D-Generation X. You have a partner named Hunter Hearst Helmsley. Book the two of them in a tag match against Bret and, either Bret and Owen or Bret and Davey Boy, and even make it a fucking DQ finish or some shit. Bret goes over.
I think Bret would have accepted that, though. I think he still would have been slighted. Maybe not as much.
I think it would have softened it up a little bit to where he'd be like, all right, I'll do it. Because we'll be like, all right, look, if we can get you over in a tag match, even if it's just like, you know, but you get a victory over Shawn, will you please do the fucking finish? Like, it's as easy as that. And then if Shawn is just like, well, I don't want to do it like this, be like,
dude, this is the only way we can get Brett to agree to be to lose to you at Survivor Series. Play fucking ball. Shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
But it's because nobody could police the two of them.
Well, it was just in any business, but especially this one where you're in front of people all the time, egos can play a fucking... Like, this could have easily happened with Macho and Hogan.
Yeah.
What we've talked about. If Macho got... You know,
if Macho got so like,
it would have been deserved.
Macho also knew how to do business.
He did. It would have been deserved, but it's like, this is what happens when you have really big egos trying to work with each other.
Right.
It's not like MMA where it's like, all right, put these two motherfuckers in a cage and let them settle it. No, they have to work together and tell a story still,
right,
even though they hate each other.
Well, and here's the thing, like you brought up Macho Man. They had a Clash of Champions in January of '96. It was a tag match: Ric Flair and the Giant versus Hogan and Savage. Hogan wanted the finish to be him beating Flair with a leg drop. Flair had just dropped the title to Savage the night before. Flair said to Bischoff, if we go through with this finish, I'm out of here. I'm done. Hogan did not want to do the job. You can't beat the fucking Giant clean. So Savage is just like, oh, yeah, you know, I had my moment last night, brother, so pin me tonight. That's Savage doing business.
Yeah.
So, like, but... So, like, those guys could do business. Brett and Sean, I think, hated each other so much at that point.
Yeah.
None of them wanted to do business. Like, Brett would say, just so you know, Sean, I know what's best for business. Like, if I have to put you over, I'll put you over.
Yeah.
That was complete bullshit. He wanted Sean to kiss his ass. Sean had no intention on kissing his ass.
Yeah, it's one of those situations that both guys were in the wrong.
Yeah.
And... Brad will always tell the story to where he never was, and Sean is a complete scumbag. And there's a lot of truth to that, but Brett was also in the wrong for a lot, for having a big ego and being a diva. You're leaving the company, what they tell you, but you're still employed.
Yeah.
While you are employed, you do your fucking job and you listen to your boss. That is how companies work.
And when you have the guy on the other side who was already involved in a fucking lawsuit because the last champion he had come over from the WWF, while that person was still champion, Medusa, and she threw the belt in the fucking trash can, Bischoff was up to his ass in litigation.
Yeah.
So now, and you're going to have fucking Bret Hart come in with their most prized title?
Well, that's what he wanted anyway. He didn't give a fuck, though. He was controversy creates cash.
Well, no, Bischoff, like, if you listen to Bischoff, Bischoff said, drop the fucking title.
I'm
up
sure
to my ass in litigation. Again, this is what he said.
Yeah.
I'm up to my ass in litigation already because I had Medusa do this. I don't want this again. Do what you're told. Drop the goddamn title.
And listen, I love the Bish, and I'd like to say that everything he says is gospel, but he
there's about 50 people that call bullshit on it.
He's been known to stretch the truth sometimes in the past.
Including Conrad.
And there's just something that I could see, maybe he did say that, but I could also see, like, in the meetings or on the phone, like, but it would be cool if you, like, I could just see him, like, well, we need to show that old fucker. Like, Vince would fucking shit his pants, wouldn't he? Like, I could see him at least throwing the scenario out there.
Right. But, I'm saying what, like, he was saying, because he said it on Dark Side of the Ring, he said it on the Monday Night Wars episode of Legends of Wrestling. So, like, he has, quote-unquote, said that he told Brett,
and that's
do
good.
What they told you to do.
And there's probably truth to that. I can see, like, an alternate world where he was also like, yeah, do all that, and then like, But, like, if you think about it, you know, I could just see that with him. But everybody... We'll never know the truth. That's all speculation on my part. But everybody was in the wrong here, except for poor old Hebner that just got thrown into something. The one guy that I can't blame throughout this whole thing, and I've tried, is Vince McMahon, because he was losing control of his company. He was losing control of his guys, and everyone was being an ego and running the asylum and telling him what. And he put his foot down and he said, "No, motherfuckers, we're doing what I want. This is my company, and this is what we're going to do."
Well, and here's the thing. Here's the only thing I blame him for, and this time I blame him for a lot of other things. But he gives Brett a lifetime contract a year before.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things to where, like, it's almost like a tax write-off, right?
Yeah.
to where it's just like, I could save money if he's not here. So he tells Brett, get the contract from WCW. Like, I can't afford to pay you anymore. Brett thought it was a bunch of bullshit because then, you know, 2 months later they bring in Tyson.
Yeah.
But it's also Vince kind of treating it as a tax write-off. It's just like, I want to go a different direction.
Vince did not give a fuck about Bret Hart anymore, though.
Well, that's what I'm saying. He wanted to go a different direction.
Yeah, Vince didn't care. That is what it comes down to.
Yeah.
You're right. He deserves the blame in that, to where he's like, Bret's not going to be a star for me.
Yeah.
And he kind of saw the way that Bret's career went, which sucks, but...
Yeah. So, like, it's one of those things to where it's just like, he might have been in the wrong at the time by saying, you know, fuck Bret Hart, I got to get him out of here.
Yeah.
But it's also... Brett may not have fit into that attitude era. So instead of, you know, doing the deal where it's just like, okay, you know, we'll keep him around, we'll find a spot for him, it's, I need the money back that I'm supposed to pay you, or I want to free that up so I can use it for other things. And so, like, when he does all that, it basically should be, all right, you got to do this my way. The problem is they didn't want to. The inmates were so used to running the asylum to where it's just like they don't give a fuck what he says. If only they were like that now and they could just tell him to go fuck himself and then unplug his pacemakers.
Yeah.
But, you know, back then it was – because Vince McMahon was still respected at that time. Well – I don't – he should have been respected because he still was a respectable person. I don't necessarily blame him because you're going with the guy that you're keeping.
Yeah.
You don't side with the guy that's leaving, even though you're making him leave.
Well, he also thought that the future was in Michaels and the past was in Hart. And he was right on one of those things and wrong on the other because the future wasn't really with Shawn Michaels anymore either.
It was more with Steve Austin.
But who knows if the Attitude Era would have been as prominent as it was if Bret Hart stuck around.
Right.
Maybe it was a good move. The way it worked out sucks for Bret Hart, and it's great for the WWE, because all they got was publicity from it. And Vince turned it into the best heel character known to man. And they reacted the complete right way, and WCW, all they could do was crack a couple jokes here and there and bring him in a stupid role.
Right.
So that is – it's a big moment because it shows you how the shift is going to happen. Because the shift hasn't happened yet. WCW is number one, but with the way both companies handled this, you know who's going to be number one in a couple years.
Yeah.
Because one had an expert strategy to, like, turn it into entertainment, and the other one said, ooh, we got Bret Hart. We fucked Vince, yay. And did not do anything with it.
Right. Well, and if you listen to Brett, Brett's like, oh, I had to take 6 weeks off because I broke my knuckle.
Yes, and that's true. But just to finish my last point, and Bischoff's stupid for thinking, oh, we need him to fucking carry Thunder. That was never a good plan. Oh, we need more wrestlers and we need to carry Thunder. That's why we're bringing Bret Hart in. He can be the face of Thunder. Dude, that was never going to work. He could fight the NWO, he could do all this, he could put on good matches with Flair, whatever, but just to be the face of Thunder, like that's another to the multiple shows thing, why that was never going to work.
Right.
You couldn't have a face of Thunder because no one gave a fuck about Thunder. They were watching Nitro.
Well, nobody wanted Thunder.
Yeah. So it's just everything about WCW's side of that was handled wrong, and everything about WWE's, besides actually screwing him, because that's not, you can't say that's handled right. But the way they acted afterwards was brilliant, and turning it into a fucking huge storyline.
Yeah,
and a
tremendous character, by the way.
Yeah. So, it's also the reason that this is such a big deal and people still talk about it is that chaos will always be the best form of entertainment that people want to watch. People are always going to want to watch the train wreck. The thing about wrestling is that it's at its best when it's a well-oiled machine. But people don't always want to see a well-oiled machine.
Right.
People want to see shit get fucked up. People want to see real life. This was real life. This was fucking people pissed off. This was a melting, like, you look at the ring, just watch Survivor Series 97 and look at everything that's happening in the ring after that bell goes off. And it's just fucking chaos. I mean, you know the big things of him spitting on Vince and doing the WCW in the air, but just the way Bret's face is, like, hey, he's like, what the fuck just happened? Like, just his face recollecting what's going on and, like, realizing, like, oh, my God, like everything I put my heart into. Like just the destruction on his face and, like, Sean being immature and getting out. Like, everything about it is very entertaining. Yeah.
Well, and the funny thing is that, like, if you listen to other people's accounts of it, Undertaker goes back, Undertaker goes and checks on Bret along with, like, three or four other people.
Yes.
And they're like, are you all right? And he goes, no, I'm not. Like, I want to know who was in on it. And Undertaker was pissed off because Undertaker sat at Gorilla next to Bruce because he wanted to make sure that things were going to go down the way they were supposed to go down.
Yeah.
But then because they were filming that stupid Wrestling with Shadows documentary, because they were coming through, they could not, because Undertaker wasn't wrestling at Survivor Series. So he was not in his ring gear. He was not dressed as the Undertaker. He was dressed as Mark Calloway.
Yeah.
So Bruce told Undertaker, we can't have you shot in this light. We have to be in character. You need to go. So Undertaker's just like, it's kind of weird. He always lets me sit at Gorilla. What the fuck? So he goes in Vince's office and watches it. He sees what happened because, you know, Vince leaves his office to go to ringside. Undertaker's sitting in Vince's office by himself, watches what's going on. First thing Undertaker wants to do is go rip Bruce Pritchard's head off because he's like, that fucker sent me away. So I could not go out there and get involved. So then everybody comes back, but Bruce had no idea. Well, according to Bruce, he had no idea. He thought Undertaker knew. Because Undertaker went at Bruce and was like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And Bruce is like, well, you just came out of Vince's office. I just say, what the fuck to you? And he looked at Bruce and said, you're up Vince's ass more than I am.
Yeah.
So, and you're one of his stooges. So you knew.
Yeah.
I didn't know. So anyway, he goes to Bret, says, hey, is everything all right? He goes, no. Undertaker goes to Vince and says, you need to go talk to Bret right now. He goes, well, does Bret want to talk to me? He goes, no, but you need to go talk to him right now. You need to try to smooth it out. And if you get your ass kicked, oh, well.
Yeah.
He goes, and I'm going to guard the door to make sure no one comes in to help you. And so they go in. Bret's in the locker room. You know, getting ready to go in the shower. He goes, I'm going to go take a shower. If you're still here when I get out of the shower, I'm knocking you out. And Shane's just like, well, Bret, calm down. He goes, shut up, Shane. I'm knocking your old man out. Sean's trying to get the hell. Sean got the hell out of there.
Yeah, and it's fun. Well, because the cool thing about that Wrestling with Shadows thing is that it shows the initial confrontation with Sean and Bret.
Yeah.
When Bret's like, Sean, are you like, tell me the truth right now, dude. Like, you can tell he's like, I need the truth. Tell me. And Sean's like, dude, I swear to fucking God, I swear to God. Like, and he's obviously lying. And it's funny knowing what we know now.
Yeah. Well, and then Bret's wife was also confronting Hunter.
Yeah.
Because she's just like, Hunter, like, and he goes, I had no idea. He goes, bullshit, Hunter. You're up Sean's ass. You're up Vince's ass. I know you had something to do with it.
Yeah. And he did. They were all lying.
Yeah. So, like, and you would almost think at that point, you're like, oh, my God, Bret Hart's wife is going to beat the shit out of Triple H.
That would have been funny.
But then Bret comes out. You had the Hart Foundation out there. I don't even think Sean and Hunter were told to leave the building. They left the building. So you had the Hart Foundation. You had Vince, Shane, Bruce, Patterson, Briscoe, Vince Russo, JR, Jerry Lawler, Undertaker, Bryan Adams, Vader, Ken Shamrock, all in that room. Like, okay, and, you know, the Undertaker, Vader, Bryan Adams, Shamrock, and whoever else I may have just named, they were all basically there because they were all kind of supporting Bret, and they were also, like, going to be like, they knew they were going to have to pull Bret off the Vince.
Well, yeah, and Vince knew that. Vince went in the room knowing he was going to get hit.
Yeah.
Everybody went in the room knew Vince was going to get hit.
And Undertaker looked at Bret and said,
take one shot. Just take one. And that's it.
And he did.
And he did.
And he broke his fucking hand. And that sucks that that's, like, what fucking derailed the WCW shit.
Well, that's what he said. I mean, you can't work with a broken knuckle.
Yeah.
Like,
and he's a grappler, though.
So he's bad.
That would be hard.
I mean, and so I can kind of understand that. But then, like, afterwards, because then you got to remember, too, the aftermath. Guys did not want to go to, like, Mick Foley skipped Ottawa the next night.
Yeah.
And then, like, a lot of guys were calling, giving their notices, saying, fuck this, we're done. And then JR's just like, JR calls Vince and says, look, we're not going to have a TV show. Because I got, half the fucking roster just called me and said they're not coming in. He goes, call them all back, say we're going to have a talent meeting beforehand. Mick's the only one that didn't go. But they all went, and he talked to Undertaker first. He said, Mark, you have to understand why I did what I did. He goes, Brett gave you a lot of service, or Brett had a lot of years of service, and he goes, he was going to walk off with our title. So Undertaker talked to the guys first and said, look, I don't like what he did either, but he is the boss. That was his title. Brett was leaving. Unfortunately, we have to accept it.
And, like, can you really blame? And that's the thing. Everybody's at fault, but can you really blame anybody? Because Vince saw the Medusa shit.
Yeah.
They literally saw somebody leave with the belt in good favor with them and fuck them over. So who's
not? No, Vince is not in the wrong for wanting his belt back.
Yeah. So
everybody, nobody is innocent except for... You had your loyal soldier, Undertaker, trying to keep the peace, which I don't even know why.
And I still don't think Earl Hebner was just doing his fucking job. He didn't deserve anything. He didn't, like, I'm sure he did know the finish right before, and he might have, like, lied to Brett. But, like, what the fuck is he supposed to do? What is little Earl Hebner supposed to fucking do?
Bret Hart's not going to pay Earl Hebner's bills.
Yeah, and he's doing his fucking job. He's got to do what his boss says. So if the boss says, go fucking do this count and don't say a fucking word, that's what Earl has to do. So I'll never blame him. And Brett never really blamed him. He did a little bit, but he didn't totally.
Well, in that video that we did, or that that Brett did for KNS WrestleFest, you know, where we had the autograph signed for Mom.
Yeah.
Like... Earl, they did an interview with Earl, signing with Earl a couple weeks prior, and Earl said something or whatever, and Brett just basically said, he was like, look, Earl was a coward that night, but he had no choice but to be a coward.
Yeah.
It's like, well, yeah, your fucking job's getting threatened, and you can't back up a guy that's going to be fucking leaving anyway.
Mm-hmm. And, like, Earl wasn't Earl yet either.
Yeah.
He wasn't, like, the fucking, like, loved being he is now.
Yeah.
By wrestling fans. Like, he was just a referee.
And by the way, like, this actually, like, it wasn't that long after this, Earl had a heart attack.
Yeah.
So, like, a lot of this pressure was on him.
It was so, like, I remember watching The Dark Side of the Ring. He's like, these last 15 years have been the shits. And it's like, oh, poor Earl.
Yeah.
So you shouldn't have to carry all that, bro. You're just doing your fucking job.
And I love Earl Hebner.
Me too. It was a pleasure meeting him.
Yeah.
But, all right, let's move on. Number one drum roll. All right.
My hands are getting tired.
I'm going to start with Plymouth on this one. We got Steve Austin and Bret Hart from WrestleMania 13, the submission match.
Yeah. I think, you know what? I love the Bret Hart and Stone Cold feud. I think it has to be like the best match to Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart. Because I think watching Austin, I think Austin hated, even though Michaels and Bret was more of real life hate, Austin, I really thought it was on the same level, but even though you knew behind the scenes you guys had respect for each other, but you will never have guessed that in the ring.
Yeah.
And I think that's what made their matches really, really better than expected, because you really felt like this was like Bret has two main enemies in business, and Shawn Michaels and Stone Cold Steve Austin. Especially the way Austin went after Bret Hart. The hatred and the laughter was amazing. And having Austin just pass out and not tap out is really said something, then I think covers both sides. I mean, yes, you give Bret a win, but Austin never really lost.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's what make. And the thing is not only in just like wrestling, but in all of sports or entertainment or whatever, there's iconic imagery, right? And that's what really brings you to a moment is this one scene. Like if it's Nick Foles doing the Philly special in the Super Bowl, or if it's fucking like just like certain like maybe a certain knockout and like Jorge Masvidal doing the knee to Ben Askren, right?
Right.
Or just certain moments or just like certain pictures, like when that knee connects his head. Steve Austin fucking covered in blood, writhing in pain, in the sharpshooter and not giving up and just sitting there shaking his head and fucking bleeding and his face and his mouth open. Like that is a picture in everybody's mind that'll never go away. And that's what makes this so fucking special. And some people just look to that, and I'm not trying to just overshadow. I'm not trying to just say that's the only, cause that's not the only big moment in the match. The match is fucking amazing, but there's something about that image that's going to stay with people. And I think that's why this is so iconic, but also you have two different styles. You got a brawler versus like a grappler, like real, like technical wrestler. You have fucking like a brash personality versus kind of a good boy. Like there's just so many things going into this that makes it what it is. And it is probably the best match of the year.
It definitely is the best match of the year because like they, it was such a big feud, and this was the feud that really got, that really was getting Stone Cold to be Stone Cold.
Yeah.
Now, they did not think that he was going to be as beloved as he was going to be. Nobody could have pictured that, especially him. Like, Jim Ross used to go up to him and be like, you know, you're going to make one hell of a hero. Fuck you, JR. I ain't going to be no goddamn hero. Guess what? He was.
Yeah.
Yep.
And
my favorite wrestler of all
time. This match started that because Steve Austin never quit. And when he got the shit beat out of it, and then afterwards, like, when they did the whole thing, he's like, I'm not done with Bret Hart yet. And this match was, for a WrestleMania that really was not iconic.
This is an iconic moment.
Yeah.
Eric, what do you think of this one?
You put it at number one. This whole storyline started at Rumble when Bret Hart was eliminated by Stone Cold after he came back in the ring. Supposedly he was eliminated, but referees didn't see it. And I started the ball rolling for this feud, and it led up to WrestleMania, and then after WrestleMania. And that image, as you said, it just sticks in your head to this day. And this was probably, this or Ray and Eddie was the best match of the year. This was the feud of the year, the Observer. This was voted as the feud of the year '97. So. Another reason why I put it at number one, too.
Right, and it should be at number one, I think.
Yeah. I was going back and forth between this and Montreal Screwjob, but I didn't want the Montreal Screwjob to be number one because it's kind of negative in a way. So.
Yeah, and it is negative, and this is more of a positive because a lot more positive stuff came out of this.
Exactly.
So, no, I think that this was the right number one.
I agree.
Thank you.
It was perfect, and it was a great list. This was our 1997 Top 10 Matches and Moments. You did a good job, Eric. I'm excited to come back and do another year. This is a great idea. And check out all our other shit.
Yeah. Do you want me to announce what I think we should do for next week's show?
Sure.
WWF Fully Loaded 1998.
Let's do it.
Austin and Undertaker versus Kane and Mankind for the tag titles. Triple H and Rock, 2 out of 3 falls with a 30-minute time limit. Sable and Macklin in a bikini contest.
Oh, God. Yo, sounds good, boys. This is another good one.
Yep.
And we'll see everybody next time.
There's no show tomorrow, so this is why we're doing it tonight.
Yeah.
And you said 98, right?
Yep.
Yeah, Fully Loaded 98.
All right.
I'll probably watch it tonight.
You know what? I have been watching every Raw since 93, episode of Raw, and right now I'm really going into the Rumble 2017 right now. I watch every pay-per-view from first Raw all the way up to where we're at now. 5 years behind where we're at now. Huh?
Our man's on a binge.
A lot of wrestling.
No, I haven't been watched yet.
All right, guys. We'll see everybody next time.
Later, fellas.
Later. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Behold the king. The king of kings. On your knees.